It's Sunday, May 16th, and this is For Good Reason.
Welcome to For Good Reason. I'm DJ Grothy. For Good Reason is the radio show and the podcast produced in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation, an international nonprofit whose mission is to advance critical thinking about the paranormal, pseudoscience, and the supernatural. This week, we continue the broadcast of the interview I conducted with Ray Hyman, Professor Emeritus of Psychology at the University of Oregon, about as many decades as a widely respected expert critic of parapsychology. This interview was conducted last month for the occasion of Professor Hyman receiving the 2010 Philip J. Klass Award for Outstanding Contributions in Promoting Critical Thinking and Scientific Understanding, conferred to him by the National Capital Area Skeptics, a D.C. area local skeptics organization, and it was conducted at the National Science Foundation. So our interview picks up right where it left off last week. Maybe we'll finish up by exploring how we got to be skeptics, right? I find that an interesting question. But you mentioned Uri Geller, and you've spoken in the media about Uri Geller, and you've done research into dowsing and other parapsychology claims, like individual claimants, as opposed to being an expert critic of parapsychology research. Those are kind of two halves of your career, and I draw a distinction between those two kinds of efforts. Is one more compelling or interesting to you than the other? Is one kind of skepticism more important to you than the other?
That's a leading question, but yes. Yeah, I always found parapsychology dull. I find it very dull. I'm not interested in it at all. Mm-hmm. And I find that the fun part of skepticism is dealing with Uri Geller and the mediums who talk to the dead and the dowsers who not only find water, but they can find the gold and Schendley's number 9, depending on what they put in their dowsing rod or their pendulum. I find all that part fast. That to me is the fun part. The parapsychology part is not fun. I got stuck into it, unfortunately, and they always come to me. The time I put into it, to me, it's just wasted for me. I prefer to do other things.
Do you regret it? Do you regret the 50 years of expert criticism?
Not really regret, but I regret it if I think about it, in the sense that that all the things I could have done professionally and otherwise, mm-hmm. that this took up a lot of my time. Mm-hmm. It's boring, as you said, and I just don't find it fun.
And it sounds like you're more interested in the psychology of belief questions than the parapsychology questions.
Yes, definitely.
So rather than the evidence of psi, you're interested more in why people believe this stuff,
right.
despite the lack of evidence.
That's right.
Yeah. And so if you had it all to do over again, would that be more of a focus for you?
You never know, but yes.
You never know, but yes. I like that answer. I want to have some time for audience questions, but I want to ask you about the last 35 years of the movement, right? And from your vantage, you see that there's grown up around the world, not just the United States, but really around the world, a worldwide skeptics movement. When you and Martin Gardner and Randy and Paul Kurtz and others founded PsyCop, you didn't sit in some back room with some plan to create a worldwide movement, right? You were just thinkers coming together, wanted to offer criticism of these prevailing beliefs, correct?
Well, there are many creation stories about the founding of the movement, and we're going to go into some of them at the next
tab. Next amazing
right.
meeting, yes. I'll just announce for our listeners that for the first time in the history of TAM, we're going to have a panel on the history, the origins of the skeptics movement, featuring Ray and Paul Kurtz and Randy and Ken Fraser and hopefully Martin Gardner by video. So those are interesting questions. But I'm asking you about the movement aspect of it. Was there a plan for there to be a movement around these ideas and ideals?
What happened was it wasn't that well organized, obviously. But what happened, as far as I'm concerned, was the key things that led to the current skeptics movement was Martin Gardner, his Fads and Fallacies in the Name of Science. Mm-hmm. That's the That's the thing we all look towards.
One of the sacred texts.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Good way of putting it. And then there was Alice Cooper, and Uri Geller had a big hand in it. Mm-hmm. And the reason with Alice Cooper, by the way, Geller has a hand in it because 1972, I get a call from the Colonel Austin Kibler, who was then head of the Advanced Research Projects Agency, the same group that brought you the internet. That's the group that was founded by President Kennedy to be the Buck Rogers, Flash Gordon part of the Defense Department, to look into futuristic things. And I got a call from him, and I was grading papers at the University of Oregon. I got a call from him in 1982, December, saying, Ray, could you drop whatever you're doing and go down to Stanford Research Institute, where they have a psychic in captivity who they're studying.
And that was Uri Geller.
That happened to be Uri Geller. Yeah. And so I went down here, of course, and it was the most bizarre thing I ever saw. And then as a result of my report, they knew they weren't going to get any money from the Defense Department, so they took Geller on the road, and they went to New York and promenaded him in front of New York Time, on Time Magazine. And mm-hmm. Time Magazine got Randy to pretend that he was a reporter and sit in when Geller did his demo for them. And that's when Randy saw... When Geller left the room, Randy apparently replicated a lot of what Geller did and showed it was a fraud. But anyways, as a result of that, in 1972, Time Magazine had an article called The Magician and the Think Tank. Mm-hmm. And they pointed out how Randy had, that here is this psychic. So the first written public publicity Geller got in his country was a expose by Time Magazine.
And this was before PsyCup. This is 72.
Oh, yeah,
this is before,
this 72, yeah.
But you were all connected even then.
No, what happened is Geller was the one who should get the credit for connecting us. What happened was, as a result of this, I didn't know Randy that well at that mm-hmm. time. I knew of him, and he knew of me, mm-hmm. because we were disciples of Martin Gardner.
Yeah.
But I was out here in Oregon, and... So as a result of this article, you know, I'm in it and Randy's in it. We are the two key people who were exposing Geller at that time. Randy then was traveling with Alice Cooper. I knew nothing about it. I don't know.
Rock star Alice Cooper. Yeah. Randy was part of his show.
Yeah, I thought Alice
show.
Cooper was a she when he called me about it. but anyways, he was traveling with Alice Cooper. And Alice Cooper, I don't know if you know about it. I didn't know much about it. I don't know much about modern music. I stopped with Beethoven, and anything after that is too much for me. But anyway, I get a call from Randy. He's traveling. He's part of the show. Randy was traveling as a mad dentist, then later becomes a mad magician, and he cuts off Alice's head in a guillotine, and he dances around the stage. This is how they end the show, apparently, with the blood dripping from Alice's head. And then everything goes black, and then there's a long pause, and then there's a resurrection scene. Alice comes back from life, and that's how they end the show. Mm-hmm. And Randy was a big feature of it, of course. So Randy was traveling with the show, and they came to Portland, and I get this call from Randy when he's in Portland. He says, Ray, you got to come up here. Alice Cooper wants to see you. He wants you to look at a show and explain to him why he's got these problems with his fans. He's got very young teenagers like him and college students like him, but high school students have nothing to do with him. And so he figured so Randy told him about me as a psychologist and stuff like that, and he said he thought that somehow I could come up and watch the show and explain to him all that. And so this sounded already weird. I didn't know what Alice Cooper was even, or who or she he was. And then he said also, but he didn't mention the other reason he wanted to talk to me. So I went up there, and I met Alice Cooper, and it turned out to be a he. At least I think it was a he.
Yeah.
And actually, a pretty nice guy, and he's a very conservative guy, I was surprised, mm-hmm.
Devoutly religious.
Politically, yeah. And he had his nose bent, and it turned out he'd fallen, and he used to run marathons, and he'd fallen at the end of a marathon and fell on his nose. And so he knew, so when he found out I had ran marathons, we became good friends because, you know, we exchanged talk on marathoning and everything else. In all of this, you know, I was on the stage, they put earphones in me, so fortunately I was on the side, and between every act, Alice would come to me when they had a blackout come over. He acted like he was drunk. He's falling, about to fall over. He actually was addicted to beer, not to drugs. Everyone else on his troop were into bug. They were smoking all kinds of stuff. But he only drank beer, Coors beer. And and he would come to me. He would straighten up in between the acts when all the lights went off. He'd run over to me and explain to me what's going on. He said, "Now, wait this next act. You're going to see the kids are going to throw things at me. You know, they're going to be mad at me because I'm going to insult their parents." And he would explain everything. And he had perfect control of everything. But he knew more about what's going on than I did. Mm. He didn't need my advice on that. But the other thing is, in between all this, Randy took me aside and said, "You know, Ray, we got to do something about this Uri Geller business and in general, the public's interest in all this crazy stuff." And so he said, "Let's form an organization called SRI." That was his name for it. You know, SRI, he took the initials SRI and made SIR, SRI, and he meant by that Sanity in Research. So that was the first suggestion or anything. So we called Martin Gardner. So Martin Gardner and I found our group that's called SRI, we called it, and we changed it to some other names. And we started that in 1972. We had a big meeting at Martin's house, the three of us. That was it. sometime later, I don't know how we heard about it, but Marcello Truzzi, who I knew nothing about, we didn't know anything about it, contacted us and said, "Look, he heard about our group and he'd like to join if he could, and he could help us out, you know, because he's a good administrator, he'd be willing to do all the scut work for us." And the one thing that Martin, Randy, and I did not have, we did have no administrative abilities. We didn't know how to run anything. We were good idea people. We spent all the time just thinking of ideas what to do, but we weren't able.
And Truzzi, as an academic, wanted to help provide some structure to.
Exactly. Said, "That's what we need." So we said, okay. And so Truzzi became part of our group. And then the next thing happened is Truzzi met Paul Kurtz in 1976 at some conference. I don't know what it was. And they both, at that time, Kurtz was running the Humanist magazine, and had also been running articles, including by myself, on critical of paranormal stuff. Mm-hmm. So
PsyCop was originally kind of a subcommittee of the American Humanist Association or something?
We tried to make it clear that we weren't going to be connected, and that's been the point of friction ever since.
Yeah, the split. Yeah.
But what happened was that he, without asking Martin, Randy, or myself, Marcello volunteered to put us together with Kurtz and his group, and we'd form this big group called PsyCop. And so we had a big meeting in 76, and that's how it all started.
Mm-hmm. So the reason I asked the movement question is that in recent years, you've been speaking out more, suggesting to audiences that some of the approaches of the expert critics of parapsychology, some of your approaches may have been misguided. Again, don't want to put words in your mouth, but you've suggested that, conversations we've had, maybe that, you know, some of the previous approaches to criticizing parapsychology there could be a better way to do it. So the reason I asked the movement question is that here's a young, you know, we have so many new generations of people who hold you up and Randy and Gardner and others kind of as skeptic heroes, as role models, and they want to emulate your approach. They want to do what you've done and kind of continue to carry on the torch. If you're saying it might not have been the best way to go about it, well, what do you have to say to them who say, I want to, in a fair-minded way, look at parapsychology research, say, and see if it's up to scientific standards?
Well, in 1986, I wrote this article called Proper Criticism, and it's been the most repeatedly published article I've ever written. Mm-hmm. It's been every skeptics group in the world has republished it. It's been republished again. Now it's going to be republished in a commemorative issue of the skeptical movement by the British journal, The Skeptic. And so it's also been published in books and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And all it is, my article on proper criticism, is just a list of platitudes that you should know. If you're attacking someone, don't attack the person, attack the problem.
Right.
And be reasonable and be fair, be sensible. That's about it. It's a bunch of little platitudes like that. Yet it's been the most published thing. Everyone reads it, everyone praises it, and no one follows it.
Mm.
Including myself.
Mm. But what I'm trying to zone in on is if the approaches that the skeptics movement or leading skeptics have taken in the past, if it might not be the ideal way, what's the alternative? In other words, what's next for the skeptics movement? If you're suggesting the answer is not for expert critics to invest 50 years in and whole academic careers into, in a fair-minded way, looking at the parapsychological research. Well, what's the alternative?
Well, first of all, I don't know, but I do have ideas. One thing I'm going to correct now, a chance to do it. Curtis is introducing me. By the way, there's some wrong stuff also. People get information on me off the web when they wrote about me in this pamphlet that you have, the program and so on. Some of it's true. Some of it not quite true. He said I'm on the executive council. I was right from the beginning, I was on the executive council. But I think for the last 5 years, I've not been on the executive council. And I've had nothing to do with PsyCorp, not deliberately. I think it's because we have some
strategic differences, maybe.
Well, I'm not even sure it's that. They have differences with me. I don't have differences with them. But okay. But to me, the skeptics movement, one of the big things we had was allocation of resources. I've always been saying you got to live within your resources, not because I'm a Republican, I'm not, I'm a Democrat, but I do think we ought to use our limited resources. At that time when we started PsyCorp, we did have limited resources. We ought to use them wisely and most effectively. I thought we got the most bang for the buck by focusing on not trying to get to everyone in the world, but focusing on opinion makers, journalists, and teachers, educators. If we could influence those people and help them, we're going to have the biggest audience. The other thing I thought was we were doing the most was with the Skeptical Inquirer. We were reaching the most. However, Kurtz and the other powers there somehow were more, and you used the term, I thought it was great, edifice complex.
Yeah, quoting me in front of an audience, great thing to say. But yes, I've cheekily introduced Paul Kurtz a number of times as our man with an edifice complex, wants to build an organization.
So they keep multiplying these centers all over the world. They're very expensive. They have to raise money and so on. So they're always fundraising and so on. And that's become more what the skeptics, and they, two things. The skeptics movement, since it's developed, PsyCorp, has focused more on things like building centers, spreading out, and also fighting among themselves within skeptics. And they've done nothing about trying to do the outreach, which is where we have our, we can do the most.
Okay, which
is that's one thing I have disagreed with the people right from the beginning. One likes to build buildings and raise money, and the other likes to do something that's effective, and so that's just a difference of opinion.
I think your criticism about building buildings, that's well taken. People get that, but you're drawing another distinction. You're saying rather than skeptics being geared up to engage the parapsychologist and look at the research and really dig in, rather than that, the agenda should be an outreach or public education mission, opinion leaders, journalists, teachers. That's what you've done, surely, your public appearances, your appearances in the media, but you've also spent the last 50 years doing the hard research, looking at the research to see if it's up to snuff. And I'm just trying to pin you down on this. Are you suggesting that that should be less of a priority for the skeptics movement than this public education, this public outreach?
I don't know how to answer that, because I would say my focus is not paranormal or anything like that. Ultimately, what I'm most concerned about is giving people the tools to think and to be good, better thinkers.
So it's
and somehow our education system, we've not done a good job of that. I think we can do better. And to me, skepticism, you know, in the skeptical movement, dealing with the parapsychology is just a good forum to work on those kinds of problems. If we can do it there, then we could do it elsewhere as well. And it's going to involve science. It's going to involve knowledge of thinking, you know, critical thinking. It's going to involve the things we like to pride ourselves on, and understanding the psychology of it all as well. We've got to realize that what human limitations are and what it is that is pushing people in this direction. So my feeling is that we've got to do more in that direction, and skepticism is just one tool for that.
Please join me in thanking Ray Hyman for this fun conversation. Thank you, Ray. I'd like to spend a few minutes now and the audience questions. And since this is being recorded, I may paraphrase your question. You'll have to tell me if I got it wrong so that it can be recorded. Question right back there.
Professor Hyman, two questions. I wonder if you would comment or be willing to comment on the apparent split between Marcello Truzzi and PsyCop. And the other subject of interest would be Dr. Schwartz's experiments, afterlife experiments, and his new project out there in Arizona.
Mm-hmm. That's a lot to comment on. Truzzi is a complicated fellow. You know, he came from a circus background. His father was one of the top, considered universally by those who know, as probably the second greatest juggler, circus juggler in the world, in history. Mm. And so he was born actually in Russia, I think, because his father was with the European circus. Eventually, his father ended up with the Ringling brothers, Barnum and Bailey, and that's why Truzzi grew up and went to school in Florida, because of that was the where the Ringling brothers have their camp, so on there, and their school. And so that's his, he got that interesting background, and then he became a sociologist at Eastern Michigan University. He's a person of tremendous breadth, knowledge, and into everything. But also, he was a person who was dedicated to being in the middle wherever he can. And his idea was, and we split on a lot of things. His idea was to be fair, you got to give all sides equal time. And I likened his approach to, and he never liked this for some reason, but I likened his approach to saying, look, let's say we have a plate of food here we know is certified not having any bacteria or any dangerous organisms. And stuff like that. And here we have a plate of food here that we know is just reeking with all kinds of terrible, dangerous substances in it. His approach to what's the best thing to eat is to mix the two 50-50. And his approach also was you got to give equal time to all sides, even though one side may be crazy and the other side has an awful lot of scientific evidence and everything behind it. And so I never could understand that, and we always split on that kind of thing. The guy had, and I shouldn't speak with him because you know about this because he's dead. But he was an interesting guy. He's a fascinating guy in many ways, but he also reveled in being friends with everyone. And he, one time I remember, we were both at a American AAAS meetings in San Francisco. And while there, he said, Ray, why don't you come with me? I'm going to take you to dinner over to this guy's house, who happened to be the fellow who ran the churches of the devil, Satan's churches.
Temple of Set, maybe, or the yeah. Anton LaVey?
Yeah, Anton yeah. LaVey. Okay, so we went to Anton LaVey's house for dinner.
That's great.
Anton LaVey had, unfortunately, he had a black panther roaming his house as well. And I always went, when I went to go to the bathroom, so I was really wondering, where was this panther?
So what led to the split was just this disagreement.
Let me give you an example. The reason I brought up Anton LaVey is typical. Truzzi considered him a good friend because they both had loved circus music and had some sort of similar backgrounds. But LaVey was very proud of the fact that it was that he had all these people in the Church of Satan, all these suckers, he called them, when in front of us. And he, among other things, he sold sexual objects, you know, he sold these inflatable dolls to them, and he made a big living. He was bragging about all that. And I found it kind of off-putting. And and Truzzi was always presented himself, and that's why he broke with Randy over moral issues. Mm-hmm. When Randy did the Project Alpha, Truzzi attacked him very viciously, saying that this was unethical to do. You know, to go into a scientist's laboratory and waste his money by pretending that you got psychic powers.
Yeah, for our listeners, Project Alpha is when Randy conspired to have two young magicians pose as psychic claimants at Washington University and then kind of expose the fraud in a real gotcha moment.
Yeah. And the reason Randy did this was because Randy had always been told that when he says you ought to have a magician there when you design your experiments, you're going to test Uri Geller or some other psychic, the scientists always say, or the parapsychologists who are scientists say, we don't need a magician. You know, we're scientists. We know how to control things. They can't pull anything like that on us. So in order to show that they can pull something like that, Randy did that Project Alpha, and it worked. But Trudy's total reaction was, this was unethical, an unethical thing to do, and you're an unethical person. And so that's why I did Big Fight. Right. Well, Trudy felt he was the only honest skeptic, honest broker in this whole skeptical business. I, Randy, and other people were biased skeptics, and there was the believers on the other side, and the only person who was the fair person was Marcello Trudy, and he openly said these things, you know. And we were at a meeting once, at the Naval Research Laboratory here in Bethesda. They held a meeting because Senator Claiborne Pell was very upset with the report I had made for the government on parapsychology. He said it was unfair and they shouldn't have had Hyman do it. They should have had someone else do it because Hyman's a known disbeliever or something like that. So Pell got the Office of Congressional Research, which I don't really know if it still exists, but he got them to carry on a special meeting. And they had several parapsychologists, but they had Jim Alcock and myself there, and Marcello was there. And at this meeting, Marcello stood up and said, well, look, you have Hyman and Alcock over there, but they're not the fair people. I'm the only neutral guy here in this room here. And he represents, obviously, this will startle me, because every parapsychologist always assumes and openly thinks that Marcello's on your side. All the skeptics thought Marcello was an enemy. So, but Marcello thought he was the only neutral person. He thought he was the one person in the middle.
I want to try to get some other questions. Any right here?
I'm curious your thoughts on James Randi's approach with the $1 million challenge. Do you see that as a good way to investigate, or what are your thoughts?
I have never been a fan of waving a $10,000 check and then ultimately a $1 million check. I don't think that's a good approach to me, but I understand the approach that why Randy and the public, probably to the public, it appeals more. It's a put up or shut up type of thing. But it makes no sense to me as a scientist. It doesn't prove anything one way or the other. But I just have to say it's not my approach, but I can't mock it.
Question right here.
I'm so fascinated by the fact that you've worked with federal entities on these issues. Could you give us some reflection about where the hopeful ways might be to help penetrate the pseudoscientific approaches of the federal government? I give the example of the fact that FDA still allows homeopathy. We've got some strange new light device that's now been FDA approved. We've got, that's the agency I come from. We're using the polygraph right and left. And a lot of these other things are very dubious science. How can we help the federal government to think more rationally about these?
I'm not sure how to do that, because the government agencies is this big bureaucracy with all kinds of little pockets in it. And what I found was that there are pockets that do all kinds of weird stuff, but the other pockets don't know about it. And there are also real good skeptics in the area as well. The military, the CIA, I know, and some of the other agencies that I have had some direct contact with, what you have is that one side doesn't know what the other side's doing. One of the things I found was that if I could get access, and if they had a centralized database where I could check how many parapsychological things are going on, there's no way I could find out. And I don't think the President of the United States, anyone could find out, because what I find was that many of the people doing weird stuff, parapsychological work and stuff like that, like in the Navy, I found that, you only find these by accident. A lot of things that are called parapsychological work go under different names. They use code names for them. They put perception under unusual conditions. Well, that fits a lot of things, you know, underwater and submarines, up and out of space and stuff like that. But a lot of the people doing oddball ESP experiments and other stuff will use that to cover up what they're doing. So there, and this John Alexander, when I was on the Committee on Techniques for Enhancing Human Performance, which was basically the Army Research Institute put up this money to have the National Academy of Sciences look into borderline techniques such as neuro-linguistic programming, meditation, sleep in and parapsychology. Many vendors are selling techniques to various branches of the military based on these things. So we were asked to look at, see if there's any one of these things that have any possibility of being good, you know, that the government was currently then using, including, you know, using these recordings, subliminal persuasion, and so on. And most of the people, even in the agencies where this was going on, didn't know that it was going on, you know. This John Alexander, Colonel Alexander, was running a military ordnance research at Fort Meade, I think it was. And he was sponsoring the research of Cleve Baxter. Baxter was the guy in the 1960s, was the first guy to attach electrodes to a philodendron plant and showed that it responded to psychically to people, to brine shrimp being burned in another room or something like that. And that started the talking to plants movement, stuff like that. Well, Baxter's still around. He's still doing research like that. And John Alexander, Colonel Alexander, when he was running the ordnance laboratory, was funding his work. How did he get away with that? This is guns he's supposed to be dealing with, right? He did got away with it because he said, he told us ourselves, our committee, he said, look, if I spend anything over $10,000, I've got to document everything, you know, to support some research. But if I spend anything up to $10,000, I don't have to say anything about it. So he was giving this guy $10,000 a day, you know. As a separate, each one's a separate contract. So he didn't have to report it.
So no real clear roadmap on how to diminish the government's support itself for pseudoscience.
Well, what it amounts to is the government is just a microcosm of the rest of society. It's the same thing. Some parts don't know what the other part's doing, and people, there are rogues, they're all around, and it may be good or bad because there are whole areas in the CIA and Defense Department, something like that, where people go off and do their own thing, and the other rest of the people don't know about it. Even the head of the CIA doesn't know about it, you know. It's just amazing. It's just such a big bureaucracy, but also all these little pockets of people doing some strange things. And I'd like to believe that they still are a minority, but I'm not so sure. Because, the head of, when I was there, our committee was formed in 1985, then retired head of INSCOM, Army Intelligence, Albert Stubblebine III, who Tammy over here confirms for me, she knew Stubblebine. They were good friends, obviously, right? No, but she knew Stubblebine. He's the brother of Lee Marvin. He looks like him, too. So Lee Marvin's name must have been Stubblebine, too, I guess, before he changes to Marvin.
Okay, so I think we have time for one more question. Anyone? Right over here.
You've spent a lot of time in academia, and I understand that getting grant money is very, very difficult. How is it that even with really nothing to show for it over many, many years, that there are still departments of parapsychology, there's still money being awarded to research in parapsychology?
Parapsychology gets practically no funding, government funding. What little it got, by the way, a big deal was made out of the fact that the 20-year research in Stargate, you know, on remote viewing, got $7 million. That's a pittance of the military budget. But actually, the only reason that number, $7 million, comes around is because they got it from me. I was trying to find out how much was being spent only in one laboratory in California on the research they were doing, being supported by first the CIA, but then it was a national Defense Intelligence Agency, I'm sorry. Defense Intelligence Agency was, what happened was the CIA had, for the first 5 years or so of the remote viewing, they'd been supporting it, but then decided it was going nowhere, so they dropped it. But then the Defense Intelligence Agency took it over, and they were supporting it. So for 20 years, this program was going on, and no one knew how much money was being spent on it. But I just tried to find out on one laboratory how much they'd gotten, and he told me over 5 years they got $7 million of funding.
That one lab.
So I happened to mention that, and that became the word all over. Now it becomes, once you say something like that, that becomes it. And so I unfortunately was the inadvertent player. Well, so Larry King Live, when he had me on, he said, how can the government waste $7 million of our money? $7 million is a pittance, right? But he made it, so the people who were incensed about this kept emphasizing that the $7 million wasted. And the people on the other side who didn't want to interview me, they interviewed instead Jessica Utzer, she was the other part of the team, and she's the parapsychologist part of the team. if they wanted a program where they want to emphasize, look, the government's doing this wonderful stuff, it's like a remote viewing, how open, we got a great government, they would interview her. If they want to emphasize the negative, they would interview me. But during that interview, they always brought up the $7 million. Our government's wasting $7 million of your precious tax dollars.
Ray, last question, and it's really kind of a follow-up on that, and then we'll finish up. After 50 years of looking into this stuff, do you think the questions are still worth asking? Is the research still worth doing? So even if it's not government funded, is it still worth looking into all this stuff?
For my part, no. But, you know, if people want to do it, I say, okay, if they're going to do it, I hope they do it in the best way possible.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Thank you very much for the conversation, Ray Hyman.
Thank you for listening to this episode of For Good Reason. For updates throughout the week, find me on Twitter and on Facebook. To get involved with an online conversation about this interview with Ray Hyman, join the discussion at forgoodreason.org. Views expressed on For Good Reason aren't necessarily the views of the James Randi Educational Foundation. Questions and comments on today's show can be sent to info@forgoodreason.org. For Good Reason is produced by Thomas Donnelly and recorded from St. Louis, Missouri. For Good Reason's music is composed for us by Emmy Award-nominated Gary Stockdale. Christina Stevens contributed to today's show. I'm your host, DJ Grothy.